This is the Dave Glover Show with Dave, Rachel, and Kevin. Sponsored by Michael's Flooring Outlet, the flooring experts. IGotFloor.com.
You should have seen by the look in my eyes, babe.
206 DGS on KMOX. In case you weren't with us at the beginning of the show, Rach and Wheels and I are going to be heading out at 4 p.m. today because Andrew's mom passed away after a very short illness and hospital stay. And tonight is the wake and the funeral, so we're going to cut out a little bit early so that we can make it on time. And we just ask that you keep Andrew in your thoughts. He'll be back, I think, tomorrow. We'll see. He can take as much time off as he wants, but I think he'll probably be back in tomorrow. So we'll be gone at 4. Rach, want to give some away?
Yes, we are going to give away a pair of tickets. You can pick your ticket, courtesy of Live Nation. This is in honor of Concert Week. So when you call, you don't have to make your choice right now. You'll make it later. James is going to take your name and your phone number and your email address if you are the winner. And you can choose between these shows to win a pair of tickets. Hootie and the Blowfish, James Taylor, Train and REO Speedwagon, Dierks Bentley, Outlaw Music Festival, and OAR. Let's give the tickets away to caller number 5 at 314-955-1120. That's 314-955-1120. Caller number 5 gets the tickets.
Wheels, did we learn anything from the past couple of wins?
Well, they're starting to hit a little bit. I mean, you know, even though it hasn't always added up to runs, like over the weekend in Milwaukee in 4 games, they scored 10 runs. Last night, they scored 8 in the 7th inning alone. So just to kind of give you, it gives you two pictures, right? This is how good that inning was, and then this is how rough the weekend was in terms of finishing the job. But they have been getting more hits. They've been creating more traffic. I know I've mentioned this a couple times, but there are a few players that have heated up over the last 7 days or so. And now we don't know if this means anything until it's sustainable. But over the last 7 days, Lars Nootbaar is hitting for power and driving in runs and drawing walks. Brendan Donovan's gotten a little better, but not enough. But Herrera's really hit over the last week. Burleson's really hit. Nolan Gorman has come around. He got another couple of hits yesterday. I think it was a couple of hits yesterday. So there are a few. And you know what's funny is when they signed Matt Carpenter, there was a lot of consternation amongst Cardinals fans, like, oh, great. They're going to end up playing him regularly and sitting somebody else. And now they kind of need him, and he's okay. He's been all right since coming off the injured list. He's gotten on base a little bit. He's batting leadoff. So there are at least some signs of offensive life over the last few days. I mean, really over the last 7 days. Now, there are other signs, like Paul Goldschmidt still really struggling. Even though he hit a home run in Milwaukee, he is still really struggling. Dylan Carlson hasn't gotten a hit since he's come back from the injured list. He's still 0 for the season. And Nolan Arenado is really a mixed bag. Like, he got going good for a little while there. And I know he hit a home run yesterday, but he's still only 3 for his last 20. So, you know, that's a 150 average. So it's still a little bit bumpy, but there are at least some guys starting to go better.
Real question. Does your brother, the hypnotherapist, ever work with athletes?
Yes, he has. I can't name them, but he's worked with one or two guys that are Major League Baseball players.
Because it seems to me that when you have, let's just take Arenado and Goldschmidt for an example, they're both probably Hall of Fame players. They both know how to
hit. Arenado definitely is.
Yeah, they both know how to hit. What you need to do is whatever you're doing now is you need to stop it, and you need to get out of your head. And you need to return to what you've done since you were 12 years old because you're really, really good at it. It seems more about subtraction than addition.
Yeah, I will say there's also a larger question that now we have some more information on, because we talked about some of those new measurements, like what your bat speed is, how long your swing takes, like how much surface area, I guess it's not the right way, but how long it takes the swing to get through or to get done. So now that we have more of these things, we can see, all right, well, that explains some things, because they both rank amongst the longest swings in the game. Which is bad. Like, it can be bad. It's typically bad, but it's really bad when you're not combining a long swing with excellent bat speed, right? If you have great bat speed and a long swing, you survive. And you can still thrive and hit for power and hit home runs. If you have average to below average bat speed and a long swing, that's not a good thing. Well, Paul Goldschmidt has average bat speed, like dead on league average bat speed, and a long swing right now. Now, the thing that it's difficult about it is we don't have numbers from past years on this to compare. So I don't know how much different this is than it was last year or the year before. And with Nolan, He also has a long swing, and his bat speed ranks in the bottom 20% in baseball. That's a really bad combination, and it explains the lack of power. You can still maybe make some contact in those circumstances, but it's really hard to do. So there are things you can do to improve your bat speed, but it also sometimes it's not because you can't swing it harder.
Yeah.
It's because you're chasing bad pitches and that slows you down when you have to reach, or you're feeling for the ball instead of just letting it rip. So it doesn't mean you can't swing it harder than you do. It just means that you're not. That's all we know about it.
So at the risk of Rachel throwing something at me, let me bring up the debate that you had with Skip yesterday.
Yeah.
It was really very interesting, and it's a debate that is being had on Twitter.
Every day.
In every old man bar in St. Louis.
Yep.
And that is basically Skip as a very successful businessman who is the very top. He's the DeWitt of
right.
his business.
Right.
Said that, look, if I add up all the parts to one of my stores, and they should be at $10 million a year, and they're at six, then I start blaming management. And I look at myself first, then I look at my general managers, then I look at my sales managers, and I look at my parts managers. And you were saying, like, yeah, I understand why you do that, but it doesn't quite translate because there have been big changes in the way that management happens.
Right, right.
I don't think many casual baseball fans know that.
Yeah, I mean, this is part of why I try to explain these things as much as I can, because this is a true thing about baseball. I was just talking about this with Matt Pauley yesterday, and obviously Matt covered the Brewers before he moved here to cover the Cardinals. Before I came to cover the Cardinals in St. Louis, I covered all of Major League Baseball. You know, I was doing a national radio show where we talked about all of the baseball teams and writing for the Sporting News and doing that. And what you learn when you pay attention to all of the other teams is every team, every fan base basically only follows their own team. And I'm not saying that's everyone, because there are people like me that are dorks that follow everything. Like when the Cardinals game's over, I'm flipping over and I'm watching the Dodgers and the Giants, or I'm watching the Padres and the Mariners or whatever. Like, I watch probably four or five games a day. And I've been doing that my entire adult life, ever since satellite TV became a thing, and then obviously streaming. So there's a percentage of baseball fans that don't do that. I don't know what that is, but it's in the minority. Most baseball fans follow their team, and they don't pay much attention to what's happening anywhere else. So when you see something happening with your team, you think it's your team that's a problem, right? You think, what's wrong with this team, or why are they doing this thing? And what they don't realize is everybody's doing those things. Like, it's like the Wilson Contreras injury. People didn't realize that everybody around Major League Baseball has their catchers creeping closer and closer to home plate in a more dangerous position because they're trying to steal strikes at the bottom of the zone. Well, yeah, 30 teams are doing that, but you're only seeing it when it's your team, because, look, your teams play every day. This is a practical thing, right? In basketball, your team doesn't play every day. In football, your team plays once a week. You're watching other games and other teams, where in baseball, you watch your team every day, and you're not really spending the time on these other things.
And you were saying how the Tony La Russa managers...
Basically done. Yeah,
there might
gone.
Be three or four left.
And even they are not truly the power brokers, right? So Bruce Bochy he's Tony level. He's a Hall of Fame manager. He's won so many World Series, won them with the Giants, won three with the Giants, won with the Rangers last year. He is absolutely one of the great managers of modern times. And he's the manager in Texas. But he does not have say over how they develop players. He does not. That dynamic has changed, and Tony had more power than any manager the Cardinals will ever have again. Nobody's going to have that anymore, because what teams realized was this: that if you change how you do things with your manager, then anytime you have to fire a manager, or a manager retires, or a contract expires and they want to leave, you got to redo everything. So what they've done is they've done it the other way around. They have a setup thing that the way the team is going to do it, and the president of baseball operations, the front office, runs that. That way, if there's a change at the manager level, the other stuff still stays the same.
Like a shadow government.
Similar, yeah. I mean, it's the idea is that it's stability for the long term. That's determined by ownership, because the owner is the one that's truly always there for the long term. And the way that things have been done now is there's a lot more delegation. So managers used to have to cover a lot more ground. Now they have more specific areas that they are responsible for, and it's mostly just communication with the players. Here's our game plan. How does the coaching staff and the manager translate what they're getting from analytics and from scouting to give that information to players in a digestible way. How are you managing personalities? How do you recognize when somebody needs a day off or 3 days off? That's the more of the stuff they're dealing with now. Things that we think of like Whitey Ball, where it's like his gut and his, you know, the strategy is all done by data. The positioning on the fields is done by data. This is, we can see now for 5,000 pitches that this is what this pitcher does in this circumstance. And this is what this hitter does when he gets a fastball on the outside half. And that's how we want to pitch him. So that's how we're going to move our defense. Those things are a lot more complicated now than they used to be. And they're not in the hands of the manager the way that it used to be.
You'll probably hate this question. It kind of goes against all things Wheeler. But is it possible that we are metricizing and analyzing some of the sweet fun out of the game?
Oh, no, there's no question. No, that's a question that, like, the hardcore, diehard, nerdiest of the nerds like me, we ask it all the time. Like, is it becoming, because ultimately, what's it supposed to be? It's supposed to be entertainment. Sports are entertainment. So if we're taking it and making it something less fun and less romantic, and it's just more plug things in and go, is that less fun? And then what we end up finding out, or what we end up coming to the conclusion is what really is what matters is what we see, right? This is all, we don't see any of this. This is all happening behind the scenes. What do we see as a result? Well, what we see based on what we've learned now is pitchers throw really hard. And we know how to craft pitches so they do things that hitters can't handle. And we don't have a counter for that on the offensive side yet, because offense is always at a disadvantage in baseball. Looking at it the other way around in football, defense is always at a disadvantage. Offense has the advantage because they have the ball. They create the action. They start the action. They decide what's going to happen, and the defense has to react. So in every other sport, the defense is the reactionary side. And in baseball, it's the inverse. So it makes it harder for the offensive side to catch up, because there's only so much you can do. You can get stronger. You can take more swings. You can be more perfect. But in the end, the odds are still against you, right? I mean, even if you're really good, you're going to fail 70% of the time.
What do you think of making changes that even things up? Lowering the mound, moving it farther away.
What they've done with a lot of these recent moves is what they've hoped. They limited the shifting of the defense, hoping that that would spur some things. They changed the rules about how you hold runners, which has allowed there to be more stolen bases, which is adding a little more entertainment.
Made
the bases bigger. They've done a few of those things. I don't know how much they've talked about moving the mound back to try to diminish impact velocity has on things. The problem with that is one of them is injuries, because if your pitchers are moving back, they're still going to try harder. So you could risk more injuries. But even if we take that out, the unintended consequence of limiting the top end velocity is you're maximizing movement. So that ball that moves 4 inches now, if you move back 6 inches, well, that ball's going to move 10 inches now. And that could lead to more walks.
Now we're playing wiffle ball.
Right. Well, then that leads to more walks, which can be more boring. And it does lead to a little bit more difficulty in squaring up pitches if a slider gets to move 3 more inches or a sinking fastball gets to sink a little bit more. See, we have to try to calculate how does all of that add up? How does all of that work? And then when you weigh that against the health risks for pitchers, that's why baseball hasn't gone that way. And it's hard to do. And it will change, by the way. If you look at the history of baseball, you can just go look at offensive numbers. In the 1920s and 30s, the numbers boomed. It was an offensive era. It's when Babe Ruth and the 27 Yankees, all it was a big offensive era. And then you get into the 40s and 50s. 40s, it started to slow down. 50s, it boomed again. Early 60s, it boomed. Late 60s, the pitching became a thing. That's when the DH came in the early 70s, because pitching started to dominate. You've always had this up and down, and it's this counter. It's what are pitchers doing and how do hitters counter it? What are hitters doing and how do pitchers counter it? So what we saw in the 80s and 90s was the Dave Duncan style, the sinker slider, keep the ball down at the knees, keep the ball, you know, from the shins to the thighs. You don't want anything above that. Well, that worked for a long time. And then hitters countered. They changed their swings, so there's more of an upward path so they could do damage on those. So what did pitchers do, or pitching gurus do? They realized, okay, now the weakness is velocity up. And hitters aren't able to hit. And we're now in that transition phase of trying to see where the hitters or how the hitters are going to counter that. But pitchers keep stepping on the gas, like literally keep stepping on the gas pedal to throw harder.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, good analysis. 626 DGS. So Bud Light learned its lesson?
I guess so. After the whole, oh my gosh, I can't even remember the name of the girl that made everyone so upset. Dylan Mulvaney.
I was going to say Dylan Mulroney, but he's an actor.
Yeah, after the whole Dylan Mulvaney incident that I guess played out last year, the higher-ups at Bud Light have said, we are going to stay in our lane from now on. No more standing up for things or trying to put messages across. We're just not doing it anymore.
Good. I have never once in my life bought a product because they stood for something that I, you know what I mean? Maybe other people do that. Maybe they're more socially conscious than me. But first of all, Bud Light's not a person. Bud Light is a company ran by people who are there making corporate decisions. I don't think for a second that quote unquote Bud Light or Anheuser-Busch supports transgender people or hates transgender people because it's a corporation.
They're trying to sell beer.
And they're trying to get advantages by taking a stand for this and taking a stand against that. And you see what it got you. And I hope that other companies do the same thing because I don't care.
Do you? Is this a relatively new thing where companies are like, oh, we have Pride? Well, I assume just because stuff like Pride Month is so much more acceptable. But like, I don't really remember when I was a little kid, companies coming out and being like, we're super pro this or we're anti this.
It was not a thing in the 80s and 90s.
Only just like the most basic, like we're America, screw off. Like that kind of stuff. You could do like pro-American and pro-worker and pro-sports.
There was a lot of that. There was a lot of the working class stuff. Yeah,
for sure. But nothing controversial.
Yeah.
And now we know why. They lost like $5 billion. It's amazing.
Well, and I do find it interesting. People keep saying like the Bud Light boycott continues. And I'm like, are people still boycotting or did they just find better beer? Like, not to be rude, but I mean, it's just not a product where it's like, and now I'm going back. I'm sure some people really liked it and really did. But I think in general, it's like it's a light beer. You can find another option if that offends you in some way. I just don't see it as an ongoing boycott.
God, me is people don't seem to understand corporations. People would switch from Bud Light, I'll never darken their doorstep again, to Mick Ultra. It's the same guy, the same people.
Yeah.
Dive into all things Cardinals on Cardinals Conversations, your go-to location for exclusive content from KMOX. Catch it on the Odyssey app or your favorite podcast platform. Stay connected with your team. Cardinals Conversations, where the Redbird talk never stops.
237 DGS on KMOX. Stairway to Kevin.
All right, so how many times have you guys, I mean, I know we've done it for sure, and I guarantee you you've seen it on Twitter, TikTok, or you've heard people talk about the topic of people reclining their seats on planes.
All the time.
Like, this has been going on. Like, it's been a topic for a long time. Some people get really mad. Others are like, hey, they're made to recline for a reason. I wanted to throw this out there to talk about this a little bit, but then to see, like, what other, if there are other things in our minds that could be, this should be solved by now. Airlines should make the announcement as they do all of the other announcements pre-flight. Guys, the seats recline. People are allowed to recline. You don't get to complain. Because there was a story about that. I saw there was an opinion piece written by a flight attendant who's like, people complain about this all the time. And all I have to tell them is they're allowed to. Mm-hmm. They're allowed to recline as far back as that seat goes. And you are too. Why is this still lingering? Why haven't we taken control? And I guess what I really wanted to get to is, aside from this, are there other things we could just take better control of and make it more clear so it doesn't lead to people being irrationally, unnecessarily, and ridiculously angry all the time?
Yeah.
Like, how hard is this to control?
I agree.
Make it an announcement.
To me, it's always been ridiculous because it's not at your house. This is on someone else's plane who designed the plane, and they designed it in a certain way. And part of that way was that the chairs recline. So you get to recline whenever the pilot says you do, as far back as you want to. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember a couple years ago, there was a viral video of, I think it was a woman reclined in her seat, and the man behind her was like punching the seat over and over again.
I remember that.
Like, why doesn't the industry take a lead on this and just do this? Just take control of it. Stop letting people be whiny and put it out there in advance. And put it just like for a time, Let's put it on every website where you can buy a plane ticket. You agree that the seat, you understand that seats recline and you are not going to cause a scene, and make the flight attendants make the announcement at the beginning when you do all the, here's your safety belt. Yeah, we know how a seat belt works. Okay. Like, we know that. Let's clarify the things that we have problems with. If the person in front of you reclines, you don't get to complain. It's part of the deal.
I think it's mostly people who don't fly often who have a huge problem with it. And I say this as someone who has not flown a lot. So you get on one of these longer flights and it's like, you are like hurting yourself if you're not going to recline in your seat, you know? But it's really easy if you don't fly a lot to be like, you should never recline. You should never get in someone else's space. I had asked this question on Twitter maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago, and most of the replies, people were like, yeah, of course you should be able to recline.
Yeah. And if people don't like that, fine. Lobby the airline industry to change it so that the seats can't recline. And then we can have it that way.
That, you know, hurts, like, everybody.
Right, right. I don't want that. I'm just saying there are ways to do this without pitching a fight.
So do people like complain to the flight attendants,
yeah,
and stuff?
Or they, oh, just, yeah, yeah, they call the attendants over and like, they're reclined in my lap. And she's like, that's what the chairs are made to do.
Right.
I can't do anything for you. But if we were to take more control of the message and tell people in advance, this is the deal. Maybe even make the announcement at the gate.
Which
we have seats that recline.
Which you shouldn't have to.
No, you're right.
You're
dealing
with grown-ups.
We shouldn't. And I was wondering if there are any other things like this to you, because there's a couple. There's one that popped to my mind immediately. It's okay to merge at the merge point.
Yeah.
You don't have to merge 2 miles early. Every study done about traffic shows that the traffic moves better when you merge at the merge point. It's called a zipper merge. This has been studied. Yet people are road raging and they block lanes and you'll get these trucks that stick out there. I don't know what we can do to raise awareness of that, but like,
so
that should be a simple, settled thing.
So you've got a 4-lane highway and they're going down to 2, and one of them's open, but everyone's avoiding it because they don't want to be the jerk.
They don't want to be the guy.
But you're going to do it?
Well, yes. And everybody should. You shouldn't merge 2 miles early. It makes it worse. Every study done on traffic pattern shows that makes the wait longer. If everybody was just smart enough to be like, we're going to fill up all of these lanes until it's time to merge, and then you merge there where the two lanes come together, that's faster. Yet when people do it, it's like you're the idiot, but like, you're not. You're actually doing it the way that the people who study traffic say this works better. And I don't understand, like, this is why it's like this. It's like the reclining seat thing. If we could just get people to explain it better, we wouldn't have to have the extra unnecessary anger, because we have too much anger already. And if we could just diminish some of it by getting rid of the things that don't necessarily need to be there, that'd be much better.
It's 2:43, brought to you by FIRA Capital Management.
I'm Dave Glover. This is KMOX, the voice of St. Louis.
Our conversation with Ricky Horton is brought to you by Goodwill. Give hope, give local, give Goodwill.
247 DGS, time to talk to your pal Ricky Horton. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Dave, how are you?
Good, buddy. Question. So Wheels has been regaling us the past couple of days with new technologies, and we now know the bat's speed. We know if you have a long swing or a short swing. And, for example, Nolan Arenado has a very long, slow swing, which may, you know, elucidate some things, why he's not hitting for power. My question always goes back to Corey Lieg, and it is, are we turning our big leaguers into anxiety-ridden, overwhelmed by detail freaks? And maybe they just need to return to first principles. And if so, did you ever go through that as a pitcher?
Yes. I'll answer your second question first, but I'll get more on that. But it's very interesting. Last week, Ollie Marmol said to several players, he didn't tell us who, I can guess who a couple of them might have been. He said, you are not allowed for 7 days to look at a video or hear a number. You just need to play. And the whole point was, exactly what you're saying is, now the information's good, but there's a time and a place for it. So you get the information and you say, okay, well, maybe I can make an adjustment. And then it has to be feel after that. You can't overthink it. You can prepare for a radio show, but you can't be looking at your notes every second and going back to that. There's an art to it. There's a flow to it that happens naturally when you're locked in. And yes, I did it there times where I would become too mechanical, and I had to just kind of what Lance Lynn said the other day, lighten up.
Yeah, yeah, well said.
It's a really good point, too, in that there's a time to be thinking about that stuff, and there's a time not to. And if you're thinking about those things in the game, that's a problem.
Yeah, so exactly, because you're competing. You got enough other things to think about.
Right,
and
right.
So, you know, players love to talk about distractions, and typically when they talk about distractions, they're talking about social media saying bad things about them or somebody yelling at them or, you know, whatever it might be is a distraction to their schedule maybe. But sometimes the numbers can be a distraction, too, to you being freed up to be what you're supposed to be doing. And again, the numbers aren't bad, but they just have to be thought of in the right time and the right place.
And it's also an interesting dynamic too, Rick, is it seems like a lot of the younger guys are more used to it and maybe even overly reliant on it because it's partly how you measure yourself as you're being recruited, as you're coming up through the minor leagues, and then you get to the majors. Well, that's more of a normal thing for them, and maybe it becomes too much of a crutch. But guys that have been around a bit, they played most of their careers without this information.
Yeah, it's interesting. The information, I almost think that it comes a little bit from the mechanical way that a lot of people learn baseball, a lot of younger players, which is through video games. So, it kind of makes me think of what Tony La Russa was fond of saying is that they're men and not machines. And you have to kind of coach them and treat them as people that have bad days, good days, you know, and you've got to not overly automate them. But I think that, you know, pitching is not a video game. I mean, you've got to have some art to that. And I think some guys, unfortunately, kind of fall into it.
Rick, I also wanted to tell you how right you were that I would not have been a big leaguer because yesterday Wheels and I got to go take batting practice at Busch Stadium, which was a once-in-a-lifetime thing.
And how did you hit out?
I didn't get to hit because I had an emergency call and I had to go, but I got to play long toss with my buddy Wheeler. That's pretty cool, just playing catch with your pal in the outfield of Busch Stadium.
Yes.
And then I was a lifelong infielder. I got to take some ground balls from just normal guys. We're talking about orthodontists are hitting here. And it took like a nanosecond for that glove to be between my for that ball to be between my legs. It was nuts, man.
You know, what's really cool is, and you said you're in the outfield playing catch too with Wheels, which, you know, that's kind of my dream too. But
anytime, Rick, I can make that dream happen, buddy.
I'm in. But
now I'm stuck playing catch with Rooney.
There you go. So if you're in center field, you look around and you realize, holy cow, this is a big area that I've got.
Cavernous.
And it doesn't do it justice to be at the ballpark. Certainly doesn't do it justice that if you're on TV or listening on the radio, it's just a big area. And guys are amazing at covering that kind of ground. And frankly, we are not.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because, first of all, our mutual friend Scott Terry was running the thing yesterday, and he made a really good point when we're all standing in the outfield and looking at home plate, and he made the point, like, here's what the outfielders are looking at. You see all that back there? What you see are red and green seats. He said, on a Sunday, you're going to see a bunch of white jerseys and white shirts and glare from the sun, and you got to pick the ball up coming off that bat and do it well enough so you can beat that ball to a spot 40 feet from you and do that in a couple seconds.
So vision is incredibly important to an athlete, and I don't think we talk about that enough in baseball. No, I don't, because vision really matters. The guys that have great peripheral vision, that you actually have a high level of acuity also on top of that, I mean, those guys have an advantage. There's no question. By the way, speaking of Scott Terry, I hate to burst your bubble, but he can get you out if he wants to, and he can hit your bat if you want
to.
So if you hit the ball, he probably did that.
Yep.
You're so right.
He actually told us he was going to do that.
He told us that.
Well, I've known him a long time, too, and he's not wrong.
No.
He said, you just keep swinging in the same spot, and I'll hit it.
I wish big league pitchers would do that to our guys. Eight runs in one inning. I can't have any more than that.
Kind of happened last night in the seventh,
Oh, my goodness. Unbelievable. It was so much fun. And came out of nowhere, and hope it stays.
Rick, does guys like Scott Terry, he's an obvious athlete. Even at his age, you can tell he's an athlete. But he's like my size. This is not a 6'4", 6'5" guy. Al Raboski, same thing. Does that always impress you when you see a guy who's under 6 feet who can throw like that?
Yeah, you know, Sonny Gray's not that tall.
Right.
I mean,
when I see
Sonny Gray is about like Scott Terry, I would say. And they're just gifted to have an arm that has the flexibility and they get arm speed. You know, we always say, and when you're around golfers, you get that impression too.
Yeah.
That some of those dudes are really kind of skinny guys, and how do they hit a golf ball 350 yards?
Yeah.
It is really amazing. But, you know, that's just the gift they have. And I don't know if I could even explain how that comes to somebody physiologically, but clearly he's got a flexibility that most people do not have.
Rick, if there was a vibe around the clubhouse, would you see it and would you share it? I mean, I know that you're sort of like an inside guy and you keep secrets and such, but if to the extent you can, how are the guys doing?
Well, there's things you say and things you don't say, but I think the vibe is really good right now. And I think it started with the game on Sunday when the Cardinals were able to kind of get something going and then, you know, and carry that into yesterday. I think they feel really good. They're connected. They're together. And they're not kind of mad at the world. They're just realizing that we have to be better. And I would say very, very positive.
Interesting. So last thing, Rick, because you guys talked about it a little bit on the broadcast last night, and it's unusual, but when Matt Carpenter was brought back in the offseason, I don't think any fans or anybody was like, "Hey, I can't wait to see him batting leadoff again." But here he is, and he's doing a good job when the team needs him to.
He's doing a great job. He's, you know, he's got a great eye. He's able to get on base. He's good at doing that. That's number one. But, you know, he's also become, I think, more of a leader than all of us expected, too. That wouldn't have been the way you'd describe him initially as a player. Not that he was a negative guy either. Not saying that. But he's really taken that mantle on, and I think he's important to this team right now, and he gives you a scary at bat in that leadoff spot, and let's hope. I think that's going to continue for a while as long as he keeps getting it done.
All right, buddy, have a great game. We'll see you back home in a couple days.
All right, thanks, guys.